power on.
The following is a presentation of the Sovereign Technica podcast feed.
I just went live because it's actually 1 minute after, so we are
right now
rocking and rolling.
Okay,
they can just hear this stuff. Whatever, who cares?
Yeah,
Brian, you juked me, man. You're like, oh, I'm gonna be 5 minutes late. I'm like, oh, I got a couple of minutes, and I come up here, and you guys are already talking.
I was putting laundry, and the I had some extra time to put laundry in the laundry machine, so I didn't actually plug in. I was sitting in here, but I didn't have my mic plugged in or anything. I didn't have time to do all that. And I just did it. So I'm basically just arriving.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, I was. We were just coming back from the store, and so we're like, "Oh, we're gonna make it in time." And well, we did.
Nice. Good deal.
Mm-hmm.
You ready to rock and roll or what?
Yeah. I don't know what we're talking about, but we'll just talk.
Yeah,
that's never been a problem ever. So
no,
I should have thought about some of this because I have over different times, and now I can't remember any of it. But
I have a list.
So let's. One thing I do want to bring up, maybe if we have the time, is going on talking again about the world wars and the Ottoman Empire. And
oh boy,
was there a point that we didn't discuss about? I don't know if there was a point we didn't discuss about that. I don't know. Just about how the Middle East being carved up in all the states and how just to kind of.
Oh yeah, we never really got into the maps being like redrawn and stuff by the British. Yeah.
But, and the French and whoever.
Yeah, and the French. Yeah.
The complicit people there, you know, obviously had their own interest too. But if we have time, that's one possibility of a thing. I'm not pressed. It's not like this is the last one we're going to do.
Yeah, no. All right. Yeah,
we're just going to do the history of the entire world in this series. Yeah.
Got it.
I've been thinking about a lot of that.
I'll be Mel Brooks.
Iraq and then, you know,
classic
things. I don't know.
Penguin, have you seen History of the World Part 1?
I haven't seen anything. Just don't ever ask me if I've seen a movie. I've never seen any movies, basically.
Oh, I was I smoked a lot of weed, so I was a giant Mel Brooks fan. So we used to get obliterated and watch Mel Brooks movies.
And I'm Jewish, so we're it's like, well, yeah, no, viewing. I think
it's in the Torah that you have to watch Mel Brooks movies. So
yeah, no, it says right in the Talmud, it says watch all Mel Brooks movies, even Dracula, Dead and Loving It.
That was a great movie.
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
But Lucy, I'm British, so are these. And you know, she just opens up. Oh, it's fantastic. Anyway, all right.
Even Men in Tights. I like Men in Tights too.
That
was a classic.
No, I agree. When he's like he has his sword in the scabbard and they're behind the sheets, it starts to go up. It's a great flick. It really is. Yeah. All right. So now that we've derailed everything, let's go.
I'm gonna go ahead and get into the intro. So
we're doing a thing. All right, go ahead.
I just started doing it. Wow. While Brian was drinking his drink. Okay. All right. 3, 2, 1. All right, folks. Welcome back to the Agora Podcast. It's Penguin here with Sek Magora and Dr. Brian Sovereign for another episode of Into the Void. It's our 7th episode of this series as far as our official numbering. So I was for sure one. I'm really glad to be back recording one of these. I'm really excited about it. One of the most, you know, exciting things I think we record as part of this media project. How's everybody doing today?
Tired and old.
Yeah, I'll second that. hotter than hell.
I'm the youngest one here, so I can't say anything.
Right.
I'm still technically in my 30s for like a few more months.
What? Seriously?
Yeah, I'm 39.
I'm older than you.
By holy like, crap. A couple of years, yeah.
Yeah, by like 3 years. I'm 42. That's insane. I had no idea. Well,
yeah.
I think you're like, and I don't know if this is a compliment or not, but I feel like you're infinitely more mature than me. So anyway, yeah.
I've seen some shit, Brian. That's like I used to say, even like, because I've been doing physical labor my whole life. So even in my like late 20s is when I hit the first wall, you know, where you're like, oh, things hurt. Oh God, I forgot it. I didn't know that existed.
Yep.
So like, I used to say, you know, it's not the years, it's the miles on the motor. And I've got a lot of hard miles.
So. Yeah. I didn't even start doing physical outside labor till I was, in my 30s, but, I would just go like full throttle in my 20s doing work. It's not extremely strenuous, but I'd just be running my ass off, and I could not do that anymore. I'd much rather lift something heavy and take my time doing it, and you know, then be running around like I used to do. I used to run around like a hamster, just insane. But yeah, definitely time takes its toll. You can be doing it sick after all these years. I know I've got plenty more years in me, but you know, hopefully I'm not doing it forever.
Listen, say whatever you want. Maybe this is just me and I'm an insane person, but I've got a dude that works for me and he's like 24, 25. And I don't want to sound like an old bastard because, you know, I am, but I don't want to. But I could work circles around this dude. he works hard, but like still I'm like twice his age. Well, not quite twice his age, but I'm almost twice his age and I could easily outlast, do harder, am stronger, everything. So.
Yeah,
but I'm half.
It's really weird. Sounds funny, but it's true. I mean, just not.
I mean, I've also been doing it my entire life, though. So you know, I got that.
Your body's kind of primed for it. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not half the man I was when I was in my 20s. So, so it's different life that we've lived. But some of that is just, yeah, I guess it's just, I don't think it has anything to do with, like, I'm not making these young kids today kind of a thing, but it's probably just, cause, I mean, my old man put me to work when I was like 7 or 8 years old, you know? So, yeah, we had a farm and he had a landscaping company. So I was free labor.
Nah. I was a terrible, terrible worker as a kid. A lot of people get their kids to do something for them. I was a terrible worker as a kid. My parents tried, but God bless them. I don't know. They put up with me somehow. They're still putting up with me. I mean, we live in the same town. They can put up with me, but no, I try to visit them as much as I can. They obviously want me to come around as much as possible these days. But yeah, I started working a little later, but I was lucky enough to kind of get a little push to start doing it. I mean, really, technically my first time I ever got any paycheck was like in 14, and then, you know, and stuff like that. And then it just didn't work out the same way for my brother, but he ended up catching on too. And this is one of those things, like you can kind of catch on, but I think the younger, the better. And I'm not an advocate for sending the little kids down into the mines, but
send them to the mines,
send them to the mines.
There's something,
there's something to be said for a mix of work and education and play for like a lot of your life. Actually, I guess that's like all your life. You should have a mix. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be like, I understand psychology and everything, and I just totally have this philosophy that we all should agree to. But I think that the whole idea that child labor is child labor in every case is not. I don't want to exploit children and exploit their youth. You know, the fact that they're kids and can't do things for themselves. But you know, I think they, like, even at a very, very young age, like to help out and do tasks, you know.
Oh yeah, my kids, well, until a certain age, then they want to do their own thing. But my youngest loves helping. Sometimes it's more of a hint, you know, she's making more of a mess than she's helping, but you know, she loves to help and learn stuff and whatever with us. And definitely, here's a point that I often make that I don't think gets brought up enough, is I think that it's kind of weird to say, but I think child labor can prevent child abuse. So, like, I'll give you an example from my own life. My old man put me to work on a farm and doing landscaping and whatever else. And so by the time I was a teenager, I had the skill set of like a 30-year-old adult. So I had the ability to go. You know, most abusive situations, the abuser has economic power over the abused. So, like, if you think of a, you know, abused spouse, a lot of times it's not the breadwinner. They have no place to go. They have no means to escape, economic means to escape. So if you have a set of skills from child labor, you are less reliant on your parents to be able to provide for yourself, because you have a marketable skill. You have things that you are able to do yourself. You need your parents less, and you have basically, you have an exit strategy at that point.
Right.
So I went to work. I was on my own at 16, 17 working, and I didn't need my parents anymore. And my parents were very abusive, and they actually gave me my own ticket to escape, in a sense, because they put me to work so young. So by the time I was 16, 17, 18, I could outwork most other people my age. So I was making decent money right away. And I didn't need them for anything. They had nothing they could hold over my head. So I had my own apartment, I had my own whatever the thing, and I was fine. So I don't want to send kids into like precarious situations or back in the fucking coal mines either. I don't even like wage labor very much. So
yeah,
but for kids to learn like a decent skill or a little hustle, like you hear stories every now and then, you know, the lemonade stand's an obvious thing, but I like seeing like this kid figured out how to make this app or whatever the thing, and now he's selling it and he's got his own little business at 14 or whatever. Like, I love that
little, yeah, you know, I was a kid. I was a kid like only 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, I guess most people, I don't know. Oh, I felt like a kid. Most people just forget what it's like, what it was like to be a kid. They have a vague memory, but yeah, it sucked to not be able to be, you know, to basically be expected to be helpless, except in like reading, writing, and arithmetic, and basically be helpless and fully dependent, which just isn't, it's suited to a certain class, certain lifestyle that doesn't fit everybody, but just for everybody, it's just frustrating to be a child and go through puberty and everything and have and literally be only there to do book reports and math problems. I don't think it's, and then this, the kind of social relations where you're, you know, a lot of critiques of schooling. We actually should just do an episode of critiques of schooling, but like, you know, the fact that you're socializing just with people with your exact age and everything, which is really unhelpful. I know when I got into the workforce, you get your first job, your real job, like 17, 18. And the amount of like socialization and skills that the amount of catching up I did maturity wise, just by working at age 18 and 19, and I kept the job for a while, but just those ages, the amount I learned more than I could have learned. It's so much more useful to me, the social skills and the, you know, abilities to self-discipline and stuff like that, which I've always struggled with, but like none of schooling helped. It made it worse. If anything, it prevented me from gaining basic skills that kids do lack in teens and kids are looked down upon just for being so like antisocial, but I mean, like, they're being kept in these prison-like conditions. And I don't mean that lightly, like literally cinder blocks and being housed with a bunch of people your own age in a common area, like against your will, essentially. Like, it's prison-like, not just in the sense that, yeah, it's coercion. It's not just that. It is literally prison. They're fed like prisoners, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's tremendously damaging for kids. And I don't think, like, I get when more left-wing types say, you know, yeah, you shouldn't have, they don't think anybody should have to work to live, or except they do, but they don't think anybody should theoretically have to work. But that's given, okay, putting that aside, like, you should not, it's putting us in a worst case, I think, growing up, except for people, it literally only probably suits the people that have like purely academic, you know, strengths. And that's a very small percent of the population that are going to go into like academics as a career path. It's so poorly suited, you know?
Yeah, I think anthropologically, there's a really great case for what you guys are saying. I mean, you know, there's an old saying that takes a village to raise a kid. And I know people kind of bristle at that sometimes, but there's actually a lot of truth to that, you know. Or if, you know, if we wanted to be more anthropological, we'd say it takes a tribe to raise a kid. And that's because kids, you know, thousands of years ago, or even just a few hundred years ago, you know, how did they learn? There wasn't public school. There wasn't anything like that. It's that they hung around adults and they just you know, they, what they thought was cool was copying adults, and they would learn to work. Now the difference is, because then people bring up Penguin kind of like what you're saying, you know, where, oh, but you know, they're in whatever corporate towns, or they're in, you know, enslaved or something like that. I mean, the difference there, as far as like child labor, is it's not labor that they're seeing, like say in China. Okay. So there's, you know, kids working in sweatshops or whatever, and what they're helping make iPhones, you know, but they don't get the iPhone, as to where, when, you know, again, in the past, kids would see the direct result of their work. It'd be in their hands, or it'd be in on the table at the end of the day, or even in the morning, whatever that happens to be. And they'd get to partake in it, and they'd understand it. I think one of the, this is going to come off, well, I another thing people might bristle at, but you know, I know we all kind of work for a medium of exchange now, right? With money, and that's fine. But at the same time, you know, you don't always appreciate the work that you're doing, and it doesn't feel fulfilling because you're not really working for what you're working for. You're working for a medium of exchange. Now you can decide to do that, but for kids, I think it creates kind of a very skewed concept of what everything's about. And yeah. And it leads to unfulfilling lives overall, and which can lead to kind of what Sec was saying about abuse and other things. And it runs into problems. I mean, and this isn't even getting into, I think one of the issues we have in culture is this obsession with eternal youth, which is a really a massive problem, because we make things today, you know, it used to be like, even when I was a kid, most of say television shows were television shows that featured adults. Now there were little kid shows, yes, little kid shows, but now shows like the big shows, even the big shows that adults watch, you know, are it's all teenagers. And I find a lot of that, there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but I do find it kind of strange, as to where, for me, you know, my hero when I was a kid was not someone my age. My hero when I was a kid was Captain Kirk, or it was Luke Skywalker, or actually it was more Darth Vader, but you know, it was people like, I wanted to be something older. I didn't want to be represented in what's on the screen. I wanted to be inspired by what I saw. And that's kind of it's a weird thing when we're not really inspiring kids to, I mean, we're only inspiring them with like pictures of other children doing what, anyway, we could get lost on this,
that's
a whole other thing. Right. So yeah, we could keep talking about work.
even in the immediate sense, I think, you know, just looking at this basic mode of economy we have around us, mm-hmm. the idea that you're going to be totally dependent, not only through childhood, but through like young adulthood and puberty and then into young adulthood. And you're going to be totally dependent and totally like in the same mode of like sit still in a classroom when that's not what you want to do. I get there. They come up. They've also come up with other outlets like sports and athletics and, you know, extracurriculars for those that aren't good at sports or athletics, like I wasn't. Which also, you know, I think I had a pretty bad situation there because I didn't bloom athletically at like 19 a little bit. I mean, I saw it, but the whatever, that situation wasn't conducive for me.
You still had a ton of energy though, right?
I hated school. Yeah. I don't know. I hated school so much. I just, right. it's particularly, that's a lot in a case with a lot of our friends, I think. But the point I'm trying to make, the broader point that I'm trying to make, is that to have people so, you know, completely dependent and basically considered so useless or a problem or a drag on society or someone who needs to be watched and corralled and surveilled, I think it's really psychologically tough on like somebody who is literally a young adult. I know we want to just eliminate that category. A big problem I have is that we want to eliminate like a very large category of like the progression of human life. It's like we want to eliminate the concept of a young adult, which is not the same as like a fully grown adult, but it's not the same as a child. It's not at all feels like a child. It doesn't, being that person doesn't feel like a child. You don't have the capabilities or the lack of capabilities basically as a child, and lack of faculties that a child has, which is intensely curious and sucking a lot in mentally and using right. all their senses and learning as much as possible. And you're not doing it as much, but you are very much not quite an adult, but you very much have many of the qualities of an adult as well. Probably closer to an adult than a child, really, once you get partway through that. due to puberty and everything. And we kind of want to eliminate that and just keep them in this mode of like, you're, I mean, I know this is such a common argument, but it's tremendously frustrating, and it hampers the ability, except for like maybe the top 5 to 10% of achievers. And then everybody else, including very capable people that are just not in maybe 5 to 10%, that maybe the, you know, things kind of mold themselves to benefiting them. All the other kids, I mean, it's pretty damn frustrating. At least it was for me.
Yeah. Well, and it's insane that, you know, kind of like the path that I went on. So I, you know, like we were talking about the hard labor or the quote unquote, harder labor, the outside labor, perhaps, you know, that you guys get to experience. I've actually always wanted that kind of job, and I don't know. The cards never really fell that way, but you know,
I
pretty much
do an office or a screen. I would.
Yeah.
I need a gun.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's the thing is right. And I hear you. And like it drives me, I mean, especially now, you know, now there's too many screens. At one point screens were cool. Now they're the bane of existence, but regardless, you know, for me, it's like, okay, you know, I go and work fast food. And then what is my job? What is the one thing I do after working in fast food? I join the military, you know, and literally go and fight in two wars. And it's like something was missed there. You know, like there's some stage of development. There's something very screwy about that whole situation that, you know, you go from fast food to going overseas and fighting in some war. I mean, yeah, the schools. Yeah. I mean,
when you put it that way, when you put it that way, that is fucking crazy to go from like, here you're flipping burgers or whatever the fuck,
yeah,
and now here's a rifle and go go point it that way, and you're like what, 18 or 19 or whatever the thing. Sure. That is insane. There's no way that should ever happen in a just world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but this is, you know, again, it speaks to the point that that the way that kids are quote unquote raised today, there are just a million steps missing. There's something not right about that, because that's, you know, that's a path that so many go on, you know, including myself. And it's freaking insane when I think back on it.
But I love that I have like this disposition that but roughly I'll share while we're here, where I have like this strong sense of justice, but and I guess a very open mind, you know, politically, philosophically, or whatever, at least in some respects. But I don't just fall into these basic heuristics. Like, I'm not just a leftist or someone in this line on this position with leftists, which says the fewer minors we have working, the better. The higher of an age you are kind of pressured or coerced or whatever to enter the workforce, the better. The less people that have to basically work, the better, at the expense of like leaving people with no skills or means of like individual subsistence or like economic agency at all. You know, that's what making a large portion of society a welfare charge is. It sounds great. I mean, besides the economics of it, it's just, you know, okay, look, 30% of the people are just going to be surplus people that we're just going to warehouse somewhere, and they're going to have zero agency. That's the logical, obvious extent of like the worst of like how things go, but you know, and then have the least number of you know, basically the highest age in the workforce and stuff like that. Like, that's not really, those aren't the metrics of success. It's a lot more complex than that. It's always some very simple metric, and it's just like the least number of mine. They always have these posts on Twitter where they show like McDonald's or Taco Bell saying we can now hire 14 and 15 now hiring 14 to 15 year olds, and it's like, look, I don't want to speak about every 14 or 15 year old, but there might be a 14 or 15 year old in a certain situation that might be considering getting a job for whatever reason, that I don't want people to be coerced into having to do things they really don't want to do. But that steady paycheck might be 10 times better than being in their position without a paycheck, and might actually put them ahead of their peers in a way that their situation with schooling and their academics, just because of their life, isn't, I can't predict that thing. And I don't think there's a cookie cutter solution for everyone. And that, just cutting that option off and saying, this is victory, this is justice, I think is myopic and, you know,
Well, here's where I might. Sorry to cut you off there, but here's where I might agree with their sort of desired end conclusion, but I don't agree with their means. So, like, what I mean by that is, I am somewhat sympathetic to like what they call anti-work. So I would like to see a world where everyone, even if money, you know, exists in this world, I would like to see a world where everyone does what they enjoy doing for a living. So like what anti-work means is just like there is no undesirable labor or coerced labor, and people, generally speaking, do what they would like to do or pursue their interests as a means of providing for themselves. And there's lots of different variants of this. Some would envision a communist society for that end or whatnot. But so I think that's the goal for a lot of the people that you're speaking about, is just like, if we can just create more people on UBI or in the welfare system, maybe they will be able to not have to get a shit job at McDonald's, and maybe they'll be able to pursue their own interests would be the most charitable view of their sort of their ideals or their plans there.
That's a good way to put it. Actually, it's the most charitable.
I don't think that's actually how that works. And I don't think that obviously I'm an anarchist. I would not like to see, you know, coercion or the state involved in any of the things I'm talking about. But I actually think that less intervention in a market would result in something similar to the anti-work society that I've just described. Just it would be much more abundance and opportunity to where people could pursue their, you know, what makes them fucking happy, not what just makes them money, but what makes them happy. And, you know, and also, you know, earn their livelihood doing that. And it's, you know, I would like to see that for everyone who fucking wants it. So I don't think it's going to be solved through institutions, though. It's just never going to happen that way, like a universal basic income or anything like that. It'll never happen that way. But I think it could happen in many, many other ways. But it has to be built outside of the state in some way.
See, even way back when, you've said before that, you know, capitalism is meant to be labor saving, and like, yeah, we really oppose the use of the word capitalism for a long time, and we really do, because it's ambiguous or not helpful a lot of the times. But even if you want to, you know, we're in a context where that's a fine usage of the word. Yeah, I think capitalism is supposed to be like labor saving. It's supposed to provide us with more abundance and more goods at cheaper price, for cheaper or less resources or less time worked. And I think that when, you know, or if you don't want to call that capitalism, fine, free markets, kind of markets without these other incentives that aren't separated in the current context, but are, you know, separable from a market economy. And, you know, so I don't want to see less of that. And I guess the paradox is that the people that most want to see, you know, change and even radical change in this direction want less markets and less markets as a solution. And, I don't think that those people are bad people that are like in bad faith. They're like they're evil, and they're not arguing in bad faith. I think they're wrong. But likewise, I don't want more markets because I want your town to be run by the monopoly man and just making the 9 and 10 year olds go down to the mines, you know, because there's no government. I don't think that's how it does or would work.
Well, you know, I'll put this out, and this is kind of maybe going full circle to where we started with SEC, and I don't know, maybe we can get into something weird after, but but this is an important conversation to have. I think what SEC is doing, like what you were describing with your kids, kind of how, you know, you don't have to teach kids necessarily everything. Like, you don't have to show them the encyclopedia. You just, you want to teach them how to learn. you don't have to be their teacher other than just explain to them, okay, this is how you learn things. And in the same way, I think it's true for work as well. Okay, this is how you work. You know, or I mean, maybe we could get a little more on a finer grain and say even this is how you survive. But these are the things that don't really get taught is, okay, how do you go about this? You know, like, and I think there is a way to, you know, how to work. For example, if you're working, you know, you're going to encounter other people. There's going to be some element of customer service, you know, but how many people are taught anything remotely like customer service? And I don't mean like the dregs of, you know, working at Target or something like that and having to deal with all that nonsense, but just in general, how to interact with people. I mean, that's kind of something missing. And I think we'd be better off basically, okay, you know, here's the foundation of how to do this. You know, you lay the foundation and then, you know, let the kids figure it out. But that's a whole other thing too, in that, you know, a lot of times, and this is, I don't have the answer to this, but also kids, and I can say this for myself as well, kids don't even really know what they want to be, you know, yet. I mean, hell, I don't think I knew what I wanted to be until I was like 30 something when I found out like what I really wanted, you know, to do and be. But then
100%. All of
your right. But then all of your energy, all of your time, all that youth, that youthful energy is just squandered in some ways by on what society thinks is the thing that you should do, or what you're told is somehow worthwhile, or whatever. I mean, me, you know, when I was a kid, a teenager, so this, people will laugh at this. I've talked about it before on my own show, but I was a championship roller skater, and I was a championship roller hockey player, and that's what I wanted to do. Now, I still enjoy roller skating. That's fine. But for fuck's sake, I don't want to do that for the rest of my life. No way. But at the time, that's all I could think about, you know, was doing that. And so, you know, I'm glad things worked out in a very different way, because I'd be defining myself by, you know, the quads on my feet. But that's a big thing that we're not really appreciating. I mean, yeah, the message is out there. Oh, you know, little Johnny, you can do and be whatever you want. And that's fine, you know, to get that out there. But the system itself is set up in such a way that, you know, kids are essentially required to figure out, you know, by the age of, say, 13, 14, when they first go to the guidance counselor in high school, and the guidance counselor asks them, okay, so what do you want to do? What do you want to go to college for? What do you want to do this? And it's like, holy fuck, man, I'm 13. You know, give me a break. I don't know. I mean, that should be the response. But society is set, at least in the West, society is set up in such a way that, no, you have to have this figured out early on. And I think that creates incredibly depressed individuals, either in, you know, not long after that, or maybe even decades after that. And that leads to a whole ton of problems.
I think it's I think it's very related here that the school system was set up to create obedient soldiers and workers. So, you said the platitude that they, you know, tell every kid, oh, you can be whatever you want to be, when really, the economy, if everyone was what they wanted to be, the current economy would collapse. They need a population of workers and, well, soldiers too, to work the stuff, to do the, you know, the shitty jobs or sit in a cubicle or whatever the thing is. They need, currently the way our economy is set up, they need a certain amount of people to not chase their dreams. And I think, I don't want to say it's entirely intentional, but I think that's where all the incentives sort of drive this entire system. And I think that's might be part of the reason why they keep kids for so long. So like, if you allowed kids to like try things, so try something different, or try to start a business at 12, 13 years old or whatever the thing is, and actually teach and develop the skills and facilitate the things that they need to try to do that, they would have like tried and failed several times by the time they're actually like a full grown adult. And maybe they would have figured out what they want to do, maybe not for their whole life, but for the next decade or so. And the abilities to make that happen, it takes like a series of like trial and error to really kind of, number one, figure out who you are, what you want to do, and how to make, you know, your what you want to do come to fruition. Like, that all takes like several attempts before you really can. And some people never figure it out, but that's going to take you several tries before you can actually like figure something out for at least a while. And you're absolutely right, Brian. It's like, nope, you don't have any of that at all. And then now you have to make that decision right at fucking, you know, in your junior year in high school or whatever the thing. And that's what you're going to fucking do for the rest of your life. Instead of like giving the people the chance to like figure it out. And I think it, I think if they allowed people to figure it out, people might not do the jobs that the powers that be need them to do to keep this entire system going.
Yeah. So first off, I do want to agree with what you said. Like the idea that I was 18 year old, you know, obviously definitely destined for college. You got to go. And I don't even know, I'm in college learning what the jobs are. I'm supposed to pick a major. And then I'm still learning what some of the jobs were in my 20s, even in my 30s, just to understand what some of the jobs out there actually entail. But some of that's more general, more specific knowledge than you need to know to choose, maybe choose your interest. Except you really don't know until you kind of dip your foot into something exactly. I was definitely being asked, like, what's your intended major, when I didn't even know what most jobs were. And I was not prepared for that either. Not that it's anybody's job to prepare you for that. I mean, they tried. There was such thing as a career day. I get that. But anyways, even if we don't live in a world where everybody can just pursue their dreams or whatever, that's great. It's a great ultimate like conclusion or whatever. But even if people of a younger age and young adulthood have to work a job that they their first job or second job that they find crappy and tedious, and it's a wage labor job, and you know whatever, I think there's tremendous value in making money and using money as a medium of exchange, because you can use it to buy various goods to your preference. Sure. Or whatever. But even in a situation where, I mean, right now you're filtering for the people I think that are the most economically precarious, as most parents see it as their duty to keep their kids out of the workplace until the workforce until they're at least 18. So you're seeing a kind of a skewed picture. But in general, like being able to earn a paycheck and learn how to budget and save your money, and these are famously skills that people will decry or not taught, and that people don't know. But there's not really a way for them to learn. Even if you made a class, that wouldn't really transfer the skills to them, I don't think, in a way of actually doing them. And like I said, there's a socialization and learning the ability to work and do things and manage your time and everything. I was not able to learn those because by being told to do those things or being assigned homework, that was just not going to work for me. It did not work for me. I resisted it. I didn't do it. I got in trouble for it. And to this day, I'm paying for not listening to my parents and teachers growing up. And I'm not saying I'm some great anti-authoritarian like hero. I just didn't want to do stuff, but I would go to work and basically do what I'm told there. And to the extent that I was able to mature in that environment. And I think it would be a lot more conducive to a lot of the issues where a lot of younger people don't adapt well to the school environment. And does that really mean that they would not adapt to an environment where they're like earning money for being there versus being in a semi-carceral environment?
Yeah, you know, something that a trend that's happening right now in workspaces, and this is partly due to, all right, we'll say the pandemic, we'll just put it out there. But it was starting to come up before then. And this is the 4-day work week. Okay, now you might be wondering, well, what does this have to do with this? And that is, you know, there's like, shall we say, shit work that I would be willing to do as long as I'm not doing it 8 hours a day, right? Like, in fact, we have the research now to show that most people, like their creativity and their ability to work, you're lucky if you get a good 3 hours out of anybody, you know, with, you know, for their maximum amount of energy to really get things done. Now, So this idea of the 4-day work week started becoming a thing because of this research that, well, you know what? You don't get that. You know, people really, they need more time off. They, you know, they got to let their brains recharge and, you know, and all of this stuff. But the problem is like, okay, so I remember reading about, you know, the concept of a 4-day work week or whatever, you know, years ago, like 2014, 2015, around there is when the idea, I think, really started to blossom. And now people are implementing it partly because of, you know, the work from home schedules and everything. But what most companies are doing, you know, instead of it being, okay, you work 8 less hours a week, you know, because you're only working 4 days a week, but you get the same amount of pay, right? Because you're still putting out the same amount of work. Instead, you're still working 40 hours a week, but they're just jamming it into 4 days. And for me, there's no real benefit there. And I'm bringing all of this up basically to say that I think, you know, there are a lot of, and I know Kevin Carson, who you guys have had Kevin Carson on in the past, haven't you? But Kevin Carson,
we've had him on, big fan.
No, he's phenomenal. And he's, I think he's even brought this up in some of his work that, or in some of his books that, you know, in a quote unquote, you know, more anarchist society, or mutualist society that, yeah, okay, there's people who might have to clean the toilets or do whatever, but you're only going to do it for like, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours a week, even, you know, like it's not going to be that much. And I think that's where people would find it to be a bit more palatable. And this isn't even new. You know, Nietzsche even said that. Nietzsche said that, you know, your work should never be more than 25% of your day. You know, and he was saying that 200 years ago. So,
Brian, remember this point right now and then go look into your patron's Discord, just for the record.
Okay.
It's going to be an interesting one. I promise you that.
All right. Do we want to talk about something weird, or do we want to keep going on this?
Well, yeah, we can. Penguin, you got any more on this? I mean, we could talk about this for like a day.
Yeah,
I just missed the mute button. Yeah, I think we can move on. I think we've actually done a great because it was impromptu. Just so everybody knows, we don't actually prep anything in advance.
I know that came out of nowhere. I don't know,
but
that was awesome.
You guys do a docket, but I'm just too busy. Like, I don't know. I just kind of try to think of things.
But I didn't look at it before that. That was just out of nowhere.
I got a quick
bone to pick with Brian.
Yeah.
So I was listening to your Sovereign Tech X episode while I was working outside a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys had the goddamn nerve to call Dream Theater, Animals as Leaders, and Devin Townsend prog rock. And I am offended, sir. That is progressive metal, not progressive rock.
Yeah. All right.
Rush, King Crimson, ELP, that's progressive rock. Granted, there is probably some overlap, but it's not the same thing.
Right on. Okay. So, A, you're right. my second point, and this is something I rarely ever really like to use the word rock. Prog metal just isn't as common as saying prog rock, and partly because that rolls off the tongue really nicely. But I've talked about this on some of my shows. I mean, anything with an electric guitar, you know, I call it metal, even though I know there are drastic differences between rock and roll, hard rock, metal, you know, black metal, death metal, and so on. You know, I mean, I do get it, but yeah, no, I stand corrected. So,
well, I accept your apology.
Thank you.
I mean, I love prog rock too, but it's like a vastly different thing. Yeah. I don't know. Well, no, they're absolutely related, but it's like it's a different vibe. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Cause like, okay. So would Dream Theater be in the same class as Yes? No. That's funny.
But they're not the same, but they touch, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. So,
I guarantee you that Dream Theater and Animals as Leaders grew up listening to Yes and Rush, you know what
totally.
I mean? But they're metal heads, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
No, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about metal. Like, you and I are both metal heads, but we have like some very, very different taste in metal. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a wide thing, but it's still We're metalheads. You know, it doesn't matter like what your thing is. Although when I was younger, I, you know, I might have poked a little bit of fun at you for the hair metal stuff. But
well, that's a funny thing. Like, nobody wants like the hair metal stuff, you know. That all gets called hard rock now, you know, but it was called hair metal. I hate the term anyway, but
and yeah, that was hair metal when I was growing up. That was hair metal. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But you know, no one like, so you would call Bon Jovi hair metal, but then go up to any metalhead today and say, yeah, Bon Jovi's metal. They'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know, no, he's not. Even though, you know, again, I would say that, but so the terms all get very, very squishy, but the beauty of metal is that, and this is what I've always said, the reason metal is the greatest genre of music is because you can take any other genre of music and put it into metal.
Yes.
And it works. Yep. You could take country, you could take a banjo, you could take whatever the hell you want, whatever you think of, even rap, and as much as I don't care for it to be there, it's there. And you can do that. And part of that becomes, you know, where, yeah, like you and I, Zach, we can have incredibly different tastes, even though we're really part of the same subculture.
Yeah, for real.
It's just so broad.
Yeah, rap metal isn't making rap better, it's making metal worse.
Okay, I kind of agree with you there.
No, I'm with you. We can do the opposite.
Well, no, it's, you know, so it's number one, just to dot your I there. One of my favorite bands, and it used to be our intro music in the very beginning, is this band called Panopticon, and they're black metal and Appalachian folk music. It's fucking amazing, but it works. You, like you said, you can just put whatever in the metal and it fucking works most of the time. Yeah. King Diamond, that is, I mean, that is an opera. That's what King Diamond is, you know, that's straight up. Like you can put him up with any opera. So it's
Same with Queensryche. I mean,
absolutely. Exactly. Yeah, for real.
Totally.
Well, to go back to your thing about like hair metal not being metal. So like these things like evolve over time. Mm-hmm. So like now 40, 50 years later, you might not call even like a lot of Black Sabbath metal. It's very much like psychedelic classic rock, a lot of it. So, but now, because metal has changed drastically in 40 or 50 years, but compared to what came before it, bands like Black Sabbath, Deep Purple or whatever, that was fucking metal compared to what was before it. But these things like change over time, and now if it doesn't have blast beats and a fucking some guy screaming from his gut, it's not metal, right? You know, so it's like these things sort of just evolve over time. I don't know how to explain.
Yeah, I like that though. I mean, because the importance of rock and roll, and you could say that's the origin of metal, and of course rock and roll, you know, came out of varying forms of, you know, black music, which, you know, thanks Satan for that, and I mean it. Just listen to Robert Johnson and you get it. But, you know, it started with rock and roll, and rock and roll always has to be about pushing the limits of not just itself, but of civilization, of culture. It always has to be rebellious. And so even though I'm not really one for kind of the screamo stuff, I like my vocals clean. I like my melodies. At the same time, I love the fact that metal is still continually pushing the limit, as to where that's another thing no other genre of music really does. Country doesn't really push the limit, other than say like Hank Williams III, where he goes into like punk and into very weird psychedelic spaces, which is fine. But like, you know, pop and rap, I mean, they're still all kind of following formulas and everything, as to where metal just refuses to have a formula and it just keeps pushing and pushing. And I'm so grateful for that, even if, you know, I'm not going to put on Cannibal Corpse every time, but I might every once in a while.
There's a video, maybe, of me changing my daughter's diaper, and we're listening to a song by Cannibal Corpse called "Hammer Smashed Face."
Yeah,
and I'm dancing with her legs and stuff to the beat and stuff, and she's just laughing and laughing. There's another picture of her. I had just taken a shower, and I had my Bluetooth speaker in there, and I was listening to this band called Sludge. And it's like very like prog technical death metal. And she's in there like headbanging, like naked, just like rocking out. I'm like, this is fucking awesome. I don't know where that came from. But so my background in metal is a lot of the very brutal death metal. That's what I first got into. That was like my first love, you know, aside from like, I was really into White Zombie and Pantera when I was a kid, but that, after that, I was, it was like fucking Cannibal Corpse and Deicide and whatever. And at that age, I was actually much less interested in the, like, I heard Opeth then, and I'm like, nah, this is not brutal enough. For anybody who's listening, Opeth is a very progressive metal band. They have a lot of like jazz influence and classical, and they have some clean vocals as well as growls and stuff. But to me, it's not metal enough, man. It's not metal enough. So, but it really took me like a long time to really appreciate just like the weird and like the vastness, the vast space that metal can like envelop, where there's lots of like other influence. And I really started to like appreciate that a lot more, but it was like, it took me getting older and out of my teenage years, I guess, to kind of to really appreciate that. But you're absolutely right. And one thing, other thing I will say about metal, and then we can kind of move on if we want to, but there is like a brother, and I talked about this with Nick Pazuzu from the lead singer of the band Tribe of Pazuzu when we had him on, is there is a fucking camaraderie amongst metalheads that it completely ignores gender, ethnic boundaries, religion, any of that. It doesn't matter. You're a metalhead first. So you can be anywhere in the world and see somebody with a Slayer shirt, and somebody's going to go, fucking Slayer. It's just going to happen. It's going to happen. And it doesn't matter what color they are. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter how much money your daddy makes. It doesn't matter. You're a fucking metalhead first. And that camaraderie happens, does not happen with other musics except for punk. Punk's the same way. But, you know, I've been in a lot of mosh pits in my time, and they will beat the living shit out of you. But if you get fought, like, this is the example I use a lot. It's like, you get knocked down, they'll pick you up,
yes,
give you a hug, give you a sip of their beer, and you all go have a good, great time after that. And there's no, it's all love. It's all weirdly love while you're beating the shit out of each other. So, I don't know how to explain that in any other way. It's like, I don't want to call it a brotherhood because there's a lot of badass metal chicks, but it's a camaraderie that doesn't exist in many other kinds of music.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a reason it's still going strong. I completely agree with that. There's a song by Manowar. Which are pretty metal if you're going to rock them. There's a song by Manowar called Die for Metal, which is a bonus track off of Warriors of the World. And that pretty much encapsulates everything you said, Sec. The whole song is about how, you know, this guy just shows up. He just lost his job. We were just talking about work, which is kind of funny, but, you know, he just lost his job and instantly he just goes to a metal concert and guys buying him a beer, you know, and everything. And it's just that camaraderie, that instantaneous. I love that song for one, but yeah, no, it is an amazing thing. And, you know, you instantly connect with people. And, you know, I've been to all different types of concerts for all different types of music, and you feel the very different energy. You feel the camaraderie at a metal show that you do not feel at a pop show. You do not feel at a country concert. That's a whole different animal. And I'm not knocking necessarily all of this stuff. I mean, hey, I'm a huge fan of Janet Jackson, but you know, at a metal show, there really is something specific there. And I don't know if it's because it's reminiscent of Mithraic cults or what, but it's pretty amazing. We'll put it that way.
That was a great opening for a segue there, Brian.
Thank you.
I caught that. You're a professional here.
I've been told.
So yeah, I'm going to leave this up to, actually, no, I got one thing, and then we can get into something weirder if we want to.
All right.
Penguin, you got anything to add on the metal stuff?
No. Yeah. I'm glad you kind of addressed hair metal. I've always wondered how hair metal in that whole era kind of fits in with the whole thing. But I guess it's like the left and right. It kind of don't really match over time. It's a kind of ever changing thing, because it's all I've always wondered generally just how that fit into American culture.
The 80s and a lot of
cocaine. It predates me.
The 80s and a lot of cocaine. That's how that.
It's some catchy music, but yeah, the aesthetics of it. I just I get that it was a thing. I don't know. I just don't can't know where it came from or where it went.
Yeah, I think it, well, I'll say that very quickly, and then we'll move on. Hair metal, I think, was a response to
disco.
Well, yeah, oh, certainly response to disco, totally, and because disco became a big deal, why? Because it was sexy, you know, everybody's dancing to it and doing whatever else, and metal needed sexy, and that's when hair metal became a thing.
Interesting.
And, yeah,
because a lot of stuff was a response to disco. There was a lot of different responses to disco culturally. Disco was apparently a hugely polarizing thing. Because there was all the rednecks like stomping on disco records, and there was there was punk that came out of a backlash against disco. There was rap that actually came out of a hip hop like music came out of I don't know, like some of the a lot of all the 70s music and the breakbeats and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much of that there. I'm sure there was a part of that was a reaction to the disco, but I know like punk and a lot of hard aesthetics. Were a reaction to disco, as well as, you know, I know all the country musicians hated disco and everything, and there was a big reaction, like I mentioned, on that side. So it's just funny. I think disco was a bit, which so like predates my life, not just my memory. I think that was a very polarizing time for people.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, you know, and just to bring up too, it's also MTV, because MTV was a visual medium. And hair metal was easily the most visually distinct and relied on its visuals. Think like Kiss, you know, even before they took the makeup off, at the time. And so they were just tailor-made for this thing called MTV, which was such a massive cultural force that people just don't realize today. Let's get weird.
Yeah, I was not a MTV fan back in the day, sure. But I did like Headbangers Ball. That was definitely watched a lot of that.
So, definitely.
They put a lot of bands on there that they were not super famous either on Headbangers Ball. So
I would have never have heard Faith No More if it wasn't for Headbangers Ball, and I'm eternally grateful. Yeah.
I had you pegged for a Patton fan. I fucking love
big time.
Mike Patton. So
big time. Mr. Bungle, whole thing. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Tomahawk. I love the Melvin stuff, too, his work with the Melvins, the Phantomas and the Melvins. But anyway, obscure bands nobody's heard of. Anyway, so we didn't get into – you know what's weird is we actually covered – we have a list, for those who don't know, of things that we – want to talk about but are afraid that we'll forget, and we weirdly like touched on several of those things without trying, which is fucking weird. Like I have being productive in here, and also anti-work, and metal's also in here.
Yeah,
and that's fucking weird, because we just I swear to God we didn't plan that at all, but that's
no I haven't looked at that list in a while, so yeah.
Me neither. I just now pulled it up. But I wanted to – we didn't get a chance to go into pacifism last time. Oof. And I want to just – no, I don't want to do a big thing, but like we don't have to do a whole thing on it. But like you call yourself a pacifist, and I just want to know, like, what does that mean to you?
Sure, yeah. So if somebody wanted to, say, read entire books on the matter – I'll just bring this up at first, but then I'll get into it more personally. But the Global Center for Non-Killing, which was started by Gene Sharp, who, yes, did his research for the CIA. I don't think that makes something inherently wrong. In fact, I think it makes it inherently interesting. It might end up being used for nefarious purposes, and I think a lot of Gene Sharp's work was. But just because something was CIA funded, again, does not make it like unworthy research whatsoever. Otherwise,
go ahead. Just to interrupt, I think James C. Scott also worked for the CIA in some capacity.
I can believe that.
So, I think they were funding a lot of stuff over the years.
Yeah,
also, I mean, Thornley, the one of the guys that created the Church of Discordia was apparently working for the CIA for a while.
Well, understand. I mean, or go ahead.
No, just everybody was apparently. That's just how it went in the 70s or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so we talked about this, I think, maybe in the last Into the Void. I mean, but I'll be very brief, but just that, you know, the CIA came out of, effectively came out of the U.S., kind of came out of the U.S. Army, right? Before, you know, before there was a CIA, we had the OSS that would exist in varying times of need. And so, you know, part of the Army, in fact, I was in this, I was 36 uniform, that was my MOS, you know, is psychological operations. Now they still have that there, but that was, you know, a lot of the 36 uniform department years ago, before there was a CIA, you know, would go into the CIA. And it, so you could argue that while, yes, its purpose is espionage, part of it, you know, its initial, okay, how do we do great espionage, was understanding psychology, was understanding the human psyche, you know. So the idea that the CIA funds things that end up becoming, like, say, the work of James C. Scott, you know, looking into, you know, anarchism or whatever else, or, you know, in other populations that, like Nzomia, right, where they're China continues to have a problem with them, we just can't conquer and tax these people, goddammit. Or, you know, somebody starting the Church of Discordia and so on. It's not a surprise, because that's the research the CIA was interested in, even if, you know, I mean, sometimes these people didn't know they're even being funded by the CIA, quite frankly. But anyway, that just laying out a little bit of history and just making sure the point is clear, that because when I've brought up Gene Sharp before, instantaneously everybody just says, oh, he was working for the CIA. And it's like, and what? Almost everybody, honestly, has worked for the CIA at some point, whether they realize it or not, you know, and so that argument doesn't really hold water. You need to disprove what the person's saying first, regardless. So if anybody wants to, you know, kind of read up on that, I think it's a very worthwhile read. Gene Sharp has done a lot of research on real world examples of pacifism, you know, kind of his mainstay things. And this will get into, you know, my point on it. One of his mainstay things is that just because there is an occupying force within a specific geography does not mean that it is the dominant force. Just because there's an occupying force does not mean that it is inherently the government of that geographic area. And he brings up a lot of examples where this is true. Ukraine, a lot of areas of the Middle East. People could even argue that Pakistan, you know, Palestine, sorry, the Palestinians, not Pakistan. Well, actually, Pakistan, that's a different subject. But the Palestinians, you know, may recognize a different government than Netanyahu, right? So, you know, just because there is something that claims to be the controlling force doesn't mean that it has to be, and that there can be, you know, pacifistic resistance and a completely, there can actually be opposing governments in the same geographic area. So anyway, read up on Gene Sharp, the Global Center for Non-Killing. It's really, really fascinating stuff. Okay. So now getting into my own pacifism. I think the first thing that I always have to say is that when I say pacifism, it doesn't mean that you can't throw a punch. It doesn't mean that you can't push somebody. Okay. My pacifism is more specifically non-lethality, okay, or like Gene Sharp would call it, non-killing. I consider pacifism, you know, going as far as you can to ensure a lack of lethality, a lack of death. You know, I refuse to kill somebody, and that's ultimately my pacifism, is that I refuse to kill another human being. Go ahead.
Sorry, I want to dig into the details a little bit, because everyone seems to have a slightly different view of what pacifism is. And some people, I do not consider myself a pacifist, but the way I've heard some pacifists describe their views, I'm like, well, I mean, I agree with that. That's not what I thought pacifism was, though. You know, like, mm-hmm. so like just now you said going as far as you can to not engage in lethal acts, or I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I'm misquoting you, but essentially that's what you said.
Yeah. Yep.
And so where's that line? Like, so is there a line that you could cross that, or is there a line that somebody could cross that you would engage in a lethal act? Cause I think everyone has, like, I don't think violence is everybody's first, or even lethality is everybody's first choice. Mm-hmm. I think people get pushed to a certain point and then engage in a lethal act. And then, like, mine would be protecting my kids. Mm-hmm. And so, like, where is that line for you? I guess would you take a life to save your own or the one of your loved ones? You know what I mean? Like, if you had to.
Yeah. So there's a great saying. It's supposedly a Chinese saying, even though I think it's an Americanism, but whatever. There's a great saying that those who think, now I'm forgetting exactly how it goes, but, those who think, you know, that there's always essentially those who think that you have to use violence at some point has never had a mosquito on their balls. And I like that a lot.
Who was that? Confucius?
Yeah, something like that, right?
it's attributed to him, but I don't think Confucius ever.
I think it's an Americanism, but I love that, you know. So as far as what the line is, if there is a line, I mean, I would say right now there is no line. But would I know in the future, could something happen? I mean, I guess maybe, you know, and, you know, the human brain is in many ways incredibly versatile and incredibly resilient, but then it is also in other ways very fragile. So, you know, we it's very hard for somebody to say these things with any real definitiveness. I like to think I'm an incredibly intelligent guy and have spent much of my life figuring out ways to avoid conflict or even avoid lethality. I mean, even if we want to talk about war, Sun Tzu, of course, one of his most famous sayings in The Art of War is that the greatest warrior never, you know, basically never goes to war. And his meaning in that is that the real battle is always psychological. The real battle is not one where, you know, the greatest warrior actually never has to go to battle because the enemy might be so terrified of him, things like this, whatever. And I mean, I could get into an entire diatribe around self-defense, and it's more because self-defense is more than just like knowing things. I mean, yeah. So I'm, you know, expert in Krav Maga, but self-defense has almost nothing to do with any kind of martial art, has almost nothing to do with, weapons, with guns, with things like this. It's self-defense is 90% psychological. A person, effectively, a person who knows what they're doing with their body or with whatever implement they have with them, would, you know, even the smallest person will beat somebody over 6 feet tall, 250 pounds, jacked as fuck, who doesn't know exactly what they're doing, you know. So kind of going around this, but bottom line being, I don't know of a line that I have where I wouldn't engage with this. That said, you know, a pacifist is, of course, always welcome to walk away. And so if I was in a scenario where, okay, like, no, I didn't kill this person, but they find themselves in a situation where, you know, it could be lethal to them. You know, I'm not necessarily required, or I'm in no way required to save them, you know, in that sense. I think if I were to put it really simply, my pacifism is I'm Batman. I mean, I'm not Batman, but you know, the idea, I'm not one for guns. I'm just not going to kill people.
So, you know, something I say to like, people I know, it's like, you know, the best way to get your vehicle, unstuck from the mud, you don't get your vehicle stuck in the first place.
Yes, exactly. So
you're right that I think most conflict can be avoided. And I don't mean this in like a, I don't mean like you walk away or you back down from a fight even. I just mean, nope. You see these things coming ahead of time and you avoid dangerous situations of all kinds. You know, you kind of think about things ahead of time and you're make sure you're aware of your surroundings, and these are all self-defense too. You know,
yes.
You use your brain to not get yourself in a shitty situation in the first place where you're cornered and have to fight or anything like that. So I agree with what you're saying. And I value nonviolence quite a bit. I have a weird love hate relationship with violence in the sense that I actually enjoy violence. I used to really like wrestling with my friends, and I used to like, we used to do a lot of like backyard MMA and like,
sure.
I and the fights I've been in, I really enjoyed being in the fight at the time. But I also recognize, because I have a fucking brain, that this is like a bad way to solve things, and it has a lot of negative consequences. It's like sort of you know, like short-term hedonism versus long-term hedonism, where you're like, where like you can think of the long-term effects of these things, and like overall your life is much better if you can engage and solve things non-violently as much as possible. I agree with all that.
Yes.
Sometimes though, you cannot know someone's intent. So like a recent thing that went around the internet is like, you know, you shouldn't harm someone for coming in and robbing your stuff. Because and I agree, you probably shouldn't take anybody's life for fucking robbing your stuff, obviously. But, your stuff is not worth using violence. Okay. That speaks to me, and I hate to be this person, that speaks to me as someone without children, because that would be fine, but you just can't understand the intent of the person. If I knew that they were just going to grab my whatever the thing and leave, it'd be one thing. I'm not going to, it's fine. Just get out of my house, you know, whatever. I can replace stuff. I'm not worried about stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're going to do next. Right. So I'm at that point, I'm going to be at least in a ready position to use force if necessary. I'm not saying I'm going to immediately start shooting my gun, but I'm going to be ready to at that point, because I have children to protect. And it's one thing with me. If it was just me, you know, it's one thing. Like I can control the situation between me and that person very easily. It's much harder for me to control the situation between that person and me and that person, and also protect my children who cannot defend themselves at the same time.
Yeah, that's
so I have to eliminate that threat before it becomes too much. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So, I think you're talking about two things too. You're talking about one, the fact that you have kids and they're defenseless, and it's your, like, you have a duty to protect your children in a way that you might be open to more what amounts to uncertainty. If the children weren't involved. So that's one thing. The other thing is, like, yeah, you don't know someone's intent, and you're not wrong to resist somebody. You're not wrong to resist somebody robbing you or stealing from you or whatever. And then they will predictably, you know, you can't predict a situation. A, you can't know anyone's intent. But additionally, if you try to resist somebody, they'll resist your resistance. And since they don't counter your resistance, and then it's
an escalation. Yeah, now you're escalating. Yes.
Up until lethal force anyway, and you can't know whether that would or would not happen. They don't even know whether that would or would not happen at the time, because they don't have full knowledge of what they are going to do in the future for whatever various reason they're robbing you in the first place. So I think there's pretty wide latitude if it's a forcible robbery, as opposed to, like, say someone's stealing something from a distance. Would you take a 300 yard shot on somebody with this, you know, exactly. But I think you get a wide latitude when it comes to somebody doing a forcible, what amounts to a forcible felony, like a forcible
entry in your home.
People. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I hear that, Sec, and I get it. So we're dealing with a situation of unknowns, and the flip side of that coin is you don't know why the other person's doing this. And that's an issue, you know, like, okay, if they're breaking into your house and doing whatever, I mean, there's so many things that you got to be able to read of what's going on. But, you know, if we're talking about people, and I hear you that, they could hurt, you know, one of your kids, they could do this. And I get that, you know, but like, what if they're going for a can of tomatoes? What if they're going for, you know, whatever, and you find out they're stealing from you so they can feed their kids? You know, and that's the problem, is that there's so many unknowns in this. And that's one of the big reasons why my hard line is non-lethality, because I can't know what's going on in that person's mind. You know, I can't know why they're doing this. There could literally be a very, like, honestly, in my opinion, a justified reason that they might be engaging this. I know people might bristle, you know, again, there's another thing people might bristle at, but you know, would I, if I had children, or if my wife is starving, would I, and for whatever scenario's happening that I don't have
I possibly could. Yes.
Fucking right. Like, I mean, I'd be swiping everything I could, you know? Yep. So that's the issue, is that we're dealing with so many unknowns in this, and lethality is the thing you can't replace. You can replace all the shit in your house or in your store or in anything else. You can't replace the life. Right. And so that's why I can't go that distance. I mean, and of course, well, anyway, I'll stop there and let you guys respond. Go ahead.
Well, okay. So if somebody's in there stealing for fucking to feed their family, I would probably feed them. Do you understand? Like, okay, yeah, and I'm totally. I'm never going to use force just to replace my stuff. I'm not worried or I'm never going to use lethal force at least to replace my stuff. That's not happening. Mm-hmm. But they're in my home. And yes, I would try to de-escalate the situation, try to get the person to leave, all of these things. But I would at the entire time be ready to use force at any time, because I'm getting like shaky thinking about this.
Yeah.
Like, the idea of somebody coming into my home with my kids sleeping, like there's too much there. Like there's too many things that could go wrong very quickly is what I mean. Mm-hmm. I would have to, for the sake of my children, be ready to use force. Now, that would be my last resort. I'm not going to shoot somebody for walking out with my food or my stuff. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably not going to use force right away either. I would probably try to get them to leave or talk to them first. But if things go, you know, sideways and they start acting in ways that seem threatening, I don't know. I will not allow. Just for the same reason I would steal to feed my children, I would do anything to protect my children. And there's no line. There is no line. So, I mean, I would like, you would have no idea. Like, my wife and I have talked about this before, or my lady, it's scary the extent that you will go for children. It's fucking weird. It's the weirdest thing in the world, in the sense that it makes you almost more conservative in a lot of ways. Like, I mean that not in a political sense, like a less willing to take risk, more desiring routine and the familiar in certain ways. But in some other weird ways, it makes you really, really fucking dangerous. Because, like, I mean, there would be piles of bodies to protect my children. Do you know what I mean? So, like,
sure.
So like I understand where you're coming from, and I agree with you all the way up until the point where any of that fails, where any kind of non-violent, you know, communicating with them, trying to get them to leave, trying to talk to them, if they're stealing food, bro, I will fucking I'll go buy you lunch right now. Like, it's fine. Like, this is cool. Just don't come in my house like this. And, you know, if you're hungry, I'll feed you, you know, so I will do all of those things, but it starts getting real shady and going sideways. I mean, I'm going to use, at least be ready to use force, if not use force. That's just how.
Yeah. But we do have to look when we get into these arguments and everything. Maybe I'm going to have.
There's no argument. I understand, Brian.
Yeah. No, right. Yeah.
No, not arguments between you too. I'm just saying, when people argue about the use of force in general, especially use of force to defend property in general, we do have to look at reality. Like, I've seen there is like a long tradition of norms, whether it is through like historical, or I know it's Islamic rulers, when and that law is very, very specific, when a very harsh punishment for theft. But when it's food, you make an exception. Or I've seen videos on YouTube where like convenience store owners, actually they're also Muslim, that just happened to be, but I think this norm extends past that, where convenience store owners that are actually in a position to actually know that a person is stealing food, specifically they're stealing, and you know what they're stealing because you're watching them, they watch them on the camera. It was really just one of those videos that happened to show up on my feed through the algorithm, and it was like, yeah, and they let them keep the food. And I've seen like other stories like that, where literally when it's food, but so much theft, and it's definitely robbery and burglary. Like, there is not very few burglaries or robberies where someone is trying to steal food or is trying to steal specifically to support just you know, their food and shelter. And our shelter is very hard, very expensive at this point. So it's like you could conceivably you couldn't possibly know that, and you couldn't possibly have that information at the time. But very often, you're not having somebody stealing food. You're not being robbed just to pay for somebody's, you know, basic nutrition or something like that. And even if that were the case, you wouldn't have that basic sense of information. Plus, you have a sense of self-preservation, even if you don't have kids and everything. So I think, again, I think there should be a wide latitude, since you can't read minds as a third party to judge the situation. You cannot read minds. So I think there should be generally a wide latitude towards, you know, crimes of force. Now, shoplifting is a different thing. I don't think shoplifting should be just, you know, look, plenty of people own stores. They own stores themselves. I don't know if you don't have sympathy for large corporations, you know, I don't know if we're going to make different laws and different rules for different size businesses, but putting that aside, like, yeah, someone runs a store, it's going to be against their interests to, you know, have their property stolen. But that's a situation where it is there is less of a risk. There is less of a I do like to think of a situation where we're all just like independent business people, and it's 1760 and we're all independent business people, and it's ye old general shop or whatever. Fine. That's one good way to look at what maybe ideal norms should be, or in a more ideal situation, at least in terms of just a pure hypothetical. I know shoplifting discourse gets a little tricky, obviously. But at least that's a situation where generally someone is like concealing something and leaving a store, and you don't
I'm
have
pro shoplifting, by the way.
Burger yeah, burger. Same.
Yeah. I mean, again, that discourse gets tricky. I can't say that I'm pro shoplifting in all cases.
I mean, if you saw a mother shoplifting formula, no, you fucking didn't. That's where I said. But anyway,
exactly. But the point I'm saying is, at least shoplifting. Let's say it's a small business owner and we have sympathy for him. Okay, some amount of sympathy for him. At least that situation is one of like minimal threat to that person, whether or not they should have the right to stop the person or whatever. But in most situations, someone's coming up to you and pulling a knife on you, pulling a gun on you, entering your dwelling, something like that. Like, you've got to assume the worst. You got to have a sense of self-preservation, assume the worst. But, you know, I do see, obviously, I think there is a norm. Like, if somebody is literally walking out of a store, my store, or walking out of my house with a can of beans, and I see they have a can of beans in their hands, if that situation did arrive, hypothetically, that's a totally different ballpark. And that's a totally different ballpark. It's just that we don't usually in the moment have that perfect information.
Well, okay, so I'm going to bring in, and we kind of hinted at the entertainment industry earlier as well, but I want to bring it in again. I mean, I applaud a lot of businesses, even the little bit, or, you know, even entry-level businesses, will say, like fast food, where they tell you if someone, you know, comes up to the register with a gun, you give them whatever they ask for. You know, do not be the hero. Do not be the hero. And I applaud that. The problem is that a lot of our, and there's another scenario I'm going to bring in here in a second. The problem is a lot of our responses that we have to varying scenarios that we could come up with, frankly, come from entertainment. And I don't just mean TV shows or movies. It could be books, could be whatever. Like, and I think there's a real problem with that, because there's this hero complex that gets created. And the idea that if you are the hero, there is some kind of reward. And that reward is either, you know, the hero who saves the day ends up with the girl at the end, or what. And look, I'm a guy who loves action movies. Okay. You know, don't confuse me here, but there is a real problem with that, where I think how people want to react to these sorts of scenarios, or how they think they should react to most of these scenarios, are not based in reality. They are based in fiction. They're based in cultural memes that are in everybody's head. So there's that problem. And this leads to the second thing, which is a different case. Let's forget about we don't have to forget about it, but, you know, we can move on from shoplifting. And let's say it's a situation of murder. We have the statistics. We know we've had the over a century or more of cases to know this, that most murders are a one-off. It's a crime of passion. Like, this is just known. that somebody just for whatever reason snaps in a scenario or whatever, it's a crime of, it, that doesn't belittle the crime. But the point is, not everybody walking around is a fucking murderer, you know, like, or like there's only, I don't even know what the minuscule percentile of people that are Ted Bundys in the world are. If there's even one in every generation, who the fuck knows? Okay. And, but the problem is Netflix and everything else is telling us, oh, they're fucking, they're everywhere. They're, you know, oh, and you watch this show and this drama and this and this and this, and oh, everybody's out to fucking get everybody and everybody's a goddamn murderer and everybody's, you know, when that's just not true. And we know that it's not. Now, again, I'm not belittling the one-offs, but we really can psychologically, you know, after it's done. And when we know for a fact, that's the person that did it. You know, we can analyze these things and realize that, okay, this was a one-off. This is, there's not just a bunch of bad people going around, you know, and that's another one of the major issues with this is that everybody,
well, I think go ahead. I just want to interrupt. I think an important thing, a distinction to make too, because I watch a lot of true crime and stuff like that, and interrogations and stuff like that. True crime videos, really popular, really well produced stuff on YouTube. So it's great, you know, source of entertainment. And everything.
Sure.
I want to point out that even though there, even with a lot of these cases of murder, there's almost always a relation between the perpetrator and the victim. So it's often friends or family. And it's pretty shocking. But I mean, if you're talking about in cases of, I mean, it's still pretty rare, obviously. There's street violence. You put the street violence in one category, then you take out the people that are killing their families or spouses or some close relation like that. And you get a pretty small number. And like strangers, you get a very, very small number.
Well, yeah, and you raise a great point there, Penguin.
But even if it is, when it does happen, the fact that it's like your family member, that's not what people are thinking.
No, right. And you know, I don't know the statistics on this, but I'm going to look it up after we do the show or after we're done with the show. I would not be surprised to find out that most murders are done by family members, like, you know, against another family member, and that the amount of murders, amount of deaths by strangers, not counting wars, which is, you know, a separate conversation, but a worthwhile one. I bet the number's astronomically high.
Boyfriend, so, girlfriend.
Most likely to be killed by your spouse.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yes. So
my mom always said that how many people back in the day used to, you know, they said that the wife or the husband just up and left, or the wife just got caught a train ticket to Oregon and everything. And really they were at the bottom of the well. Out at the farm, or they got, you know, maybe thrown to the pigs or something.
Well, yeah, it probably happened more so. How often did it happen? Yeah.
And you just never know.
But this is the thing, is that this is not, other than the true crime stuff, you know, which I know is wildly popular these days. You know, most of the cultural messaging, whatever that comes from, does not parlay that fact, you know? And if you're scared, well, I got to have a gun because somebody's going to fucking kill me. Well, you better have that gun pointed at your spouse at all times, because statistically, I bet that's where most murders occur. And, you know, but who's good? Who, you know, you say that to somebody and they're going to say it's ridiculous. And then I'm going to say, right, it's ridiculous. So what do you got, Zach?
So I think this leads to, I completely agree with you. I think this leads to kind of a broader conversation that maybe we could do another time. But I think most people value non-conflict. I don't think most people like engaging in conflict. No, violence or nonviolence. There's always that person you've met or you know that like kind of thrives on drama and rumors and whatever and the thing. But I think most people don't really like confrontation. They don't like violence. It's not very comfortable for most people in the planet. So you're right. Murders are very, very rare. Violence is surprisingly rare for the amount of, aside from war again, but is surprisingly rare considering the amount of people on the planet. And so, yeah, you're right. You look at the news and you look at all these series and the true crime documentaries, whatever, and you would think that like everybody's getting murdered all the time, when actually like murder has been steady declining for like decades and decades and decades. So, but, and you're right. You're most likely to get killed by your spouse. Here's the thing. If your spouse wants to kill you, you're not going to prevent that. It's not something you can really take action You could leave and never have a spouse, or you could like keep your spouse under constant surveillance and maybe you'll whatever the thing. But that sounds like a terrible way to live your life. And yeah, it's not,
you just can't put, never find yourself, never be in that situation.
Just never have a spouse. You. In that situation, yeah, just don't do that.
Right. I mean, what are you going to do? Put tamper-proof tape on all the antifreeze bottles? Like,
right. That's what I mean. Yeah,
you can't live like that.
Yeah, exactly right. So, and even if you did all that, they'd still be able to get around it. They live next to you. They sleep right. next to you. They, you know, right. maybe make you food. You know, you're just not going to be able to prevent that. But you might be able to prevent, like, with some basic, like, sort of operational security, like other bad things from happening, not just violence, but like, you know, yes, violence from other people, but also like, you know, accidents and that sort of thing. You can prevent those with some measures. It would be, you could spend all of your time trying to prevent your spouse from killing you and still not succeed. It's like, it's a fool's errand. There's just no way you're going to do that, but you can prevent like, you know, with basic security on your house, you can try to prevent people from coming in your house or anything like that. Or even though that is unlikely, like I'm prepared for natural disasters. This is also unlikely. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I still prepare for these things because if it does happen, I don't want to be caught with my pants down and my family's screwed and blah, 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 blah. So I have, you know, a basic responsibility for these things. Same thing with like violence. Someone committing violence against me and my family is probably super unlikely, but I'm still going to be like somewhat prepared for it. You know, like I know the entry points to get onto my property. Do you know what I mean? Like I just right. basic things like, and you know, there isn't a right answer here. This is just perspective, really. It's just a matter of subjective preferences. There's not a right answer, but, you know, like there are certain measures that you can take, including force that you would take against someone that may commit violence at you against you, just like any other sort of unlikely thing we might prepare ourselves for. So even though like this, your spouse is most likely to kill you, there's no realistic way to prevent that. So you right. just have to fucking roll the dice. It's be like, you know, trying to, I don't know. I can't think of a better, you know, like the air is bad for you. Okay. Well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do about it. I mean, I could wear a gas mask all the time, but that's never going to, you know, I'm going to have to take that off eventually. And then so it's like, it's not a realistic like comparison. No. I don't think.
Right.
To like being prepared of like a stranger coming in, which is, I mean, it's possible. It's not likely that they want to kill you, but these things, you know, can go sideways too. You know, like robberies go sideways sometimes. And Penguin made a great point earlier. It's like, okay, but you don't want to immediately go for force because now you're the one escalating this situation, and now you turned it into kind of a deadly situation where. Like, you're right. People want to be the hero. They want to like, oh, I'm going to protect my family and I'm going to shoot them and blah, blah, blah. And I'm a big, strong man or whatever the thing. It's like, no, the way, like the best case scenario in that situation is like, no one's getting hurt, right? Including my family. So if I start shooting or engaging in force with that person, there's also a chance that could go badly for me and my family. And I could have maybe solved that in a better way. And everybody walked away alive, you know, like bullets ricochet, you know, yeah. Fights break out. And once fights break out, you can't always control where that goes, you know, like, so you don't know what's going to happen, or they might also have a gun. And now you're in a shootout in your house with sheetrock walls between you and your family, you know? So I understand all these stuff. Like I have no interest in being the big, strong, tough hero, but I do want my family to be alive, you know? So
no, let me be clear where I
go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, well, let me be clear where I stand for that. I do think that if somebody is in the right or has the right to escalate forces, the person is being, you know, assaulted, intruded upon, burglarized, et cetera, being robbed or whatever, I think that person has more of a right to, you know, be the one that, I mean, obviously they have all the right to use force in terms of, I guess, rights or whatever, who's right or rights, however you want to look at it. And I think that's entirely reasonable in a lot of situations where you don't know what's going on. I mean, you don't have perfect information. You don't have, you can't even probably see the situation. So it's perfectly fine to, if someone's entering your home while it's occupied, it's perfectly fine to shoot them and kill them, in my opinion. Simple as that. I mean, it should be wide latitude to do that. I wasn't that clear about that. But there's a caveat to that, which is that that's a big deal. You're going to make a mess. It's going to be, you've taken a life. Even, I don't care what legal system, a legal order you've done, you've now taken a life and you've got it some way. Even just like the cops say, even if it's just paperwork, and it's a lot more than paperwork for them. They have to go through all this stuff too. But like, imagine if you're not a cop, like you got to answer to somebody about that situation because you've taken a life. Or, you know, in ancient times before there was an established legal order, there'd be a situation where that could start a blood feud, regardless of the situation of who was on whose property or whatever, because property rights were also, you know, primitive at the time. Or in a current legal order, for example, there's still a whole lot of people you got to answer to and still go out, you know, you might be dealing with that situation for months. I don't imagine that there is a legal order where you don't, where you do take a life, where you don't have lot of headaches, or you escalate to physical altercation. There's injuries, and the injuries take time to heal. And
this is why I don't like violence, because it causes more problems down the road.
Yes, it's still in your interest to de-escalate if possible. It's still in your interest to use as little force as possible. I think just in your self-interest, to be honest with you.
Yeah. No, I agree. I will lay out, I want to, you know, kind of cap it off with, you know, what you can do, or what I think is worthwhile that one can do, what I do, you know, to prevent these things, because there are a lot. But I mean, I won't go over all of them, of course. But something, I like what you're bringing up, Penguin, about that you have to live with it. And, you know, this conversation it's hard, especially, you know, like Zach, you know, bringing in family and all this stuff, it's hard for not to get emotional. And I don't want this argument to be emotional. And I'm not making an emotional argument here. I'm trying to be very just matter of fact. And that most of the people who want to be the hero have probably never taken a life. Now, earlier, I flippantly had stated that, you know, how I fought in two wars. Well, I actually did. And I'm not someone who, you know, I'm not some hippie here, nothing against hippies. I'm not some hippie here who's like, oh, I'll never take a life or, you know, anything like that. No, I've taken plenty, probably more than most on the planet. And I'm not proud of that. And there is a natural reaction that most, and I've seen it many, many times, that most people have when they take another life, regardless of how justified they feel. They vomit, they throw up. I mean, you feel so goddamn sick. First, second, third, fourth, fifth time you do it, eventually, yeah, sure, you get kind of desensitized to it. And when you get to that desensitization, you know, maybe then you can kind of accept it and you're ready for it and you feel more confident in doing it and things like this. And that, okay. The problem is that even, again, like I said about being justified, the problem is, and this speaks to my point, that you just don't know why the other person was doing what they were doing. The problem is that even if you think you're so justified in what you did, and know that person had to go, it was him or me, is that you can find out later on, maybe even years later on, the reality of that situation. So for me, the reality of the situation was I was in the U.S. military, and I was shooting brown people. And the realization I came to years later was that I was actually the bad guy, and I thought I was the good guy. I thought, you know, here I am being patriotic. Yeah, they did this to the, you know, the Twin Towers and everything and blah, blah, blah. No, I'm blowing up people's homes. You know, like, no shit, they came after me with a gun. Like, of course they would. And you that's one of the worst things, is that when you think about it later on, and after you've engaged in what is effectively the final solution, taking somebody's life, and you realize, motherfucker, I could have done something differently, or motherfucker, I was wrong. And that feeling, you don't yet. It's not, it doesn't even matter. Paperwork, any of that stuff, whatever. That feeling will haunt you forever. And it is the worst. It is the absolute worst. And so, you know, that's something that I think a lot of people don't realize because they think they're being the hero. But what happens when you find out you're the villain after the fact? And that it's terrible. What do you got, Sec?
I appreciate you sharing that experience. I really do. I know that was probably hard to do. So thanks for doing that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, I don't want it to be emotional. Like I consider that a fact. Like I've seen so many people vomit after the first time they've killed, you know, and there's other people where they've had this realization. I've talked to them, you know, and it's a very real thing that happens for so many. Or if they don't come to that realization, they end up with PTSD the rest of their life. And that can come just as much from defending your house as it could be your country.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, I'll back you up there because I've never taken a life, but I have gotten in some really brutal fights and beaten people pretty badly. And I was never a bully. I never really like went looking for fights, but I would never ever back down from one, you know?
Yeah, sure. Right.
And I was completely okay with escalating. I was young and stupid and angry, you know, but, and so still to this day, I can see like certain images in my head that I was probably, yeah, technically justified in that situation, but I would beat them so badly past the point that like, past the point of just like, extinguishing a threat, you know what I mean? Like, well, like, it was not proportional. And I could see like the way their face was all bruised and bloodied and whatever. And I could still see it in my head right now as I'm talking about it. So I understand that that shit never leaves you. And it doesn't, after a while, it just doesn't matter if you're fucking quote justified or not. And like looking back, you know, I was a young man then, but like looking back now, you know, fucking 20 years later or something, it's like, well, did you really have to just keep beating him after he was on the ground? You know, like, was that really justified? You know, like, so, like, I understand. Like, I understand completely what you're saying. Like,
yeah,
this is, to me, the arguments of why, like, violence is not, it's not a good route, even in your own, like Penguin said, in your own self-interest, which is the reason I don't like violence. It's not that it can be very effective in the short term, but there's a lot of like long-term consequences, including psychological, like, which is what we're talking about here, and it'll fuck you up. You know, I still think about these things now 20 years later, and it's obviously it's probably some kind of PTSD or whatever, but you know, I work through it my own way, but I could still see those images in my brain, and my memory is not good. I don't remember things well, but I can still see them. So yeah, like that's, you're right. You have to live with these actions too. And that, you know, your mental health isn't nothing, you know? So it's also something to consider as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate you sharing that as well. Or Penguin, did you have something?
I'm just thinking that, you know, just to use as a basic groundwork, the legal standard maybe for like a justifiable homicide, even now under the current legal system, which is, you know, when it comes to some of these broad concepts, they're long held things that sometimes go back to common law, and it's okay, what is the like legal and moral justification, like really broadly speaking, not looking at specific laws and passed by specific governments or anything, but like I said, broad legal traditions goes back in many cases thousands of years. What's like the standard that's in place, and is it like reasonable to like the norms of society? I mean, you're supposed to say that I have like a reasonable person would fear that their life is a danger, or the life of somebody else is a danger in a certain situation, and like, yeah, that's what you have to prove in court. And I know, you know, we have criticism of state-run courts, but I mean, just that as a general concept, I mean, like I said, you might have to give the person aggressed upon the benefit of the doubt when there's a situation where you have to give one side or the other, obviously, the benefit of the doubt. But, you know, there, you don't have a moral, you don't have the moral case for using like lethal force or for taking a life in something. And obviously, yes, it will be tough no matter how justified you were. I do agree with that, and I haven't done it, but from the evidence that I've seen, that's perfectly the case, and I would certainly expect it to be the case. But again, if it's a moral situation for you to make that choice, you did not have really a choice. You had to act in the moment if you had that reasonable fear either out of self-preservation or preservation for your companions or your children. So I don't think there's any, there's the moral aspect of this. It's not like, the worst thing you can hear somebody say, and obviously this person has never taken a life. Most people haven't taken a life, so it's not that hard to imagine that someone hasn't. But the worst thing you can hear someone say is like, how much force can I get away with in a certain situation? What situation can I shoot somebody? And you'll hear that from time to time. And that's like one of my biggest pet peeves in all of life. No categories. Like, that is one of my biggest pet peeves in the entire world, because that is not the norms of society and of any society, which universally is like against, certainly against killing and violence, you know, even if there are huge carve outs in certain situations, you know, I mean, war, obviously that is considered justified by most people, under statism or whatever, under typical norms, typical status norms. So you may have large carve outs, but the default position still is against any killing.
Yes.
And generally any violence. That is the default position. Everything else is a carve out or a caveat. So, is the case of like what's legal, and then there's the case of what's moral. What's moral has to do, only you know what you were thinking at a given time or what you perceived at a given time. What's legal might give you the benefit of the doubt in a situation, but ultimately, what's moral has to rest with you and you know, with your creator, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, if we were to get into ethics, I mean, you don't even have to get into ethics. Your body tells you, you know, like Sex said, most people want to avoid violence. Most people, when they're ready to throw a punch, they start shaking because this is just such an unnatural thing for them to do, to go and hurt another human being. Or like I brought up, you vomit after you've done it. Your body is literally telling you fucked up. You did not do something you were meant to do, you know, and there's no law books, no ethics, no nothing. Your biology is telling you, you just did something completely unnatural, in my opinion. And I think that goes beyond opinion. But anyway, Zach, did you have something?
No, I totally agree. How much time you got, Brian?
I should probably wrap things up.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave a cliffhanger because we didn't get into anything weird this time, but I think this whole conversation was beautiful, so I'm not complaining. But
sure.
For next time, I'm going to posit this, that I think that ancient peoples and indigenous peoples' rain dances were actually real. And I think that science is currently just now catching up with the possibilities of the uses of sound. So next time I'll let you, everybody here, think it's something I've been thinking about like over the past few years. I'm like, wait a minute. Cause there's a lot of like buildings that were built to make certain sounds. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of chants and
the walls of Jericho.
Yeah, exactly. but the science is really coming along recently in terms of like uses for sound. I mean, obviously they're going to use it as fucking weapons or whatever the thing, mm-hmm. but there's lots of things that can be done with sound that are provable by modern science now. So I think they're just getting it caught up, but we'll talk about that more next time if you guys want to think about that in between. What were you going to say? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just I can't wait for that. Penguin, go ahead.
Okay, go.
No, that's going to be a super cool topic. And I don't know if we have the chance just to expand on some of our at least two episodes. We've been a good point. One of the bigger points of the episode was talking about the 20th century in Middle East and North Africa, as well as other parts of the world. So I think that'd be a good topic. We can go and maybe do a little history, maybe do a weird stuff. That's our usual formula, really. I don't know where we came up with our topics today, but they were really great.
Yeah, this is a beautiful conversation.
Yeah, really good discussions.
Yeah.
It's not typical Void conversation, but it's I plan on doing a bunch more of these. So yeah, I don't know. Keep this cup narrow. Yeah.
Yeah. Really right, quick. Go ahead.
Brian, what were you going to say?
I just want to wrap up and just give some very fast recommendations to people, as far as alternatives. One thing is, so let's say, like we were talking about, statistically, the person that would likely kill you would be your spouse. Here's a great tip. Don't put a gun under your bed. Just don't be an asshole. actually be a good fucking person.
Yeah. Don't be a dick. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't be a dick. And you know, maybe you'll live. I mean, what a revolutionary thought. the other thing is, do something to be physically confident. And I don't, and that also includes, in my opinion, not carrying a gun, because a gun, I think, is a false sense of power. It can be a real one for people trained, very well trained, but for most people, I think it's a false sense of power. Have a real sense of power, as in you know what to do with your body. And that confidence, I guarantee you, will show up in your eyes, and would-be attackers, malicious actors will want to avoid that because they like easy prey. You can make yourself not easy prey in very simple ways. And I mean, even things like just going to the gym and just having a certain look to you, whatever it happens to be, you know, just get confident in your own skin and you'll see it in your eyes in the mirror as well. These are things that are not expensive to do. You don't have to go out and buy a bunch of shit. You don't have to carry anything. Be confident in your own skin. And I guarantee you that'll keep you from a lot of nasty situations as someone who grew up in New York City. So, that's all I'm going to, you know, if people want to ask more, they can ask more, but I'll just lay those points out.
Well said.
Yeah. I'm a pretty strong advocate of me carrying guns, cause I choose to do that. I think sure. Yeah, the choice to be able to do that. But I think, you know, to think that some people are under the impression that it's been the norm at any place in any time in history for, I mean, guns have been around forever, but for everyone to carry a gun, I don't know if you really can compare a knife or something to that, but it's never been the norm for people to walk around carrying a gun. You know, maybe if you're out in the wilderness or something, but it is not, that's not how the society, any society has ever really functioned. And it is not necessarily for a polite society. I'm still an advocate for it, but let's be realistic about it. That's not, an armed society is a polite society. It could be the case in some situations, but basically as a rule of thumb, no, I don't believe that.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you two quotes. I'll give you one from an ancient Japanese quote, and that is, the best swords stay in the sheaths. And the other is from a guy named Dr. Sovereign. The other one is from Dr. Sovereign. And that one is, a armed society is not a polite society. An armed society is a society built on fear. So, and I'll just leave it with that.
What was that quote? It's like, you haven't created freedom or safety. You just pointed a gun at everybody on the planet's head. You know, what was that? Right. From Captain America. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But, you know, a society built on the fact that people won't aggress against you because you'll blow their face off. I don't know. That's not a world I want to live in, but carry on.
Brian, you've been doing a bunch of crazy shit over, making a lot of moves over at Sovereign Tech. You want to plug some stuff?
Sure. Yeah. If anybody wants to check it out, just go to sovereigntech.com. That'll actually take you to now my Linktree page, which will lead you to the myriad projects going on. But lately, my wife and I have been doing our Sovereign Tech X episodes, which have been a lot of fun, talking about some really big and wild stuff that I think people would enjoy. But there's a Sovereign Technica newsletter. I just restarted my Medium page, which is getting a lot of great attention. And I'm really honored by that, getting out some great messages there, including anarchism. And actually, I'm even back on social media now. Wonders never cease. So if you want to follow me there, you can all check that out at sovereigntech.com.
Making moves. Check it out. I want to go check out that Medium because I do better. That's the one where it records the audio for you, right?
Yeah. Medium's really great because, it'll read the stories for you. Yes.
Right. Right. I might go check that out because I much prefer audio these days. It's much easier for me to do.
Yeah. And you can turn it to 2X. So, you know, you don't have to listen to me for as long, even though it's not my voice. But anyway.
Well, buddy, thanks for coming on again, man. This was awesome. It wasn't weird, but I think it was a lot of stuff that people needed to hear. So
we knocked a lot off of your list, which is good.
My list is unending, Ryan. So,
yeah, we have been recording a lot. So we had a lot, you know, probably on our minds to talk about. I definitely got out a lot that I had pinned up, I think. Still had a lot of thoughts pinned up, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant as always, Penguin and Sec. Thank you.
All right, well, thanks for coming on. I always respect and appreciate your opinion on here, so it's,
same, guys.
it's always a blast. We'll do this again in the usual time frame. So everybody listening, be excellent to each other, and don't let your spouse kill you.
Yeah. Great note to end on.
Peace.
Happens more often than anything. John.